Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer, and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons, aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates.
Hello, Podcats. How are you? I am speaking to you from Birmingham. I am here because last night I sang one of my support gigs for Steps, who are on tour at the moment. We are 3 gigs into the tour. So I had last night in Birmingham. Tonight we're in Birmingham again. So stayed up overnight. And as I chat to you, I have a very exciting view of a huge construction site out of the window of my hotel room, where they are using actually, that is quite amazing. They're using a huge crane to lower down one of the top levels of what looks like a big car park, but it's huge. Whoa, that's actually pretty cool. I like seeing things like that. I mean, overall, watching a construction site is not like a hobby of mine. I wouldn't want you to think that, but I seem to have caught it at quite an exciting moment, so that's good. And the gigs have been going well. It's quite a strange one for me because I've sung in arenas before and I've sung gigs on my own before, but I think this is the first time I've ever done a sort of solo half hour bit of me singing in an arena. And so I'm not with my band on this tour. I'm just on my own, and I come out just before Steps go on and I do half hour, and it's just this little stage with a dark curtain behind me because, you know, don't want to ruin the surprise of all the amazing staging for Steps. And it is really beautifully put together, their show. And they're having a lot of fun and it's going down brilliantly. The fans have been loving their gigs. But yeah, my job is to warm the crowd up. So I come out and I feel a bit teeny tiny. It's a bit like doing an audition because you come out, you're on your own. There's a light in your eyes. You can't really see the crowd very well. And you're just singing your way through some songs, thinking, I hope this is going okay. But the Steps fans have been gorgeous, really, really friendly. The Steps gig is really good fun. And the whole thing is just about having a really lovely, good, fun night out, which is definitely what's being delivered. So that's been really lovely. Happy days. And I can finally tell you about something that's been taking up a lot of my headspace for the last few months, which is I'm doing a challenge for children in need. So this has just been announced. If you're listening to this podcast on Monday when it comes out, it's just been announced today. I'm now talking to you from the past. This is Saturday, by the way. Hope Sunday went all right. And so in just over a week, I will be beginning a 24-hour kitchen disco dance-a-thon. What is that, I hear you ask? Basically, I'm going to the Radio Theatre in Broadcasting House, just not far from Oxford Circus. And I'm stood on a little stage that looks a little bit like a disco kitchen. And I will start dancing at 9:30 a.m. on Tuesday morning. And I will not stop. I will not stop no matter what until 9:30 on Wednesday morning. I'm going to dance my way through the day, through the night. I'll be joined with guests either in real life or on Zoom. Plenty of music. Radio 2 will be providing me a soundtrack to last me through the hours. I'm also going to be doing 5 little spot discos where I'll sing a couple of my songs and a cover. And I'm joined by special guests for that as well. So, you know, it's exciting. But I'm not going to lie, I'm a little bit nervous. And I mean, how do you prepare for that anyway? The sleep deprivation thing, generally speaking, I've got down pat. But then I've never done it where I'm not allowed to sit down for 24 hours. I think it is going to be tiring. But I think there'll be some fun there too. And I'm planning on varying my moves a lot. And if you like what you see when I'm dancing, or even if you don't, please feel free to put a couple of quid in the tip jar, because every bit of money you raise will go straight to BBC Children in Need. And I've been visiting some of the projects that benefit from Children in Need fundraising, and they are amazing. As you can imagine, I've been everywhere from a children's hospice to community centres, meeting people, talking to the people involved, hearing how the charity has benefited these different projects, and it's been incredible. So yes, you can press your red button at any point and have a look at this crazy woman dancing on her own at the radio theatre. Oh my gosh. I think the well will run dry pretty quick with the variation of dance moves, but hey, I'm here for it, baby. I'm here for it. Right. This week's guest, slightly shifting gear now, guys. So this week's guest is someone that I've wanted to speak to for a really long time, because I'm actually a really big fan of what she does. Her name is Polly Morgan. She's an artist. Her main medium is taxidermy, and she incorporates the animals in lots of different ways through her work. And she speaks about it much better than I can when we're, you know, having our chats. But her work is really beautiful and arresting. And what I really loved about the first time I saw some of her works, the first thing I think I saw was, it's like a little, almost like a cheese dome, so like a glass dome. And inside was a tiny little funeral table with a dead bird on top and a tiny little chandelier hanging above it. So her taxidermy and her art, they don't necessarily represent the animals alive again. It's not like they're reanimated. In fact, they're quite often in extremity. They either look like they've just died, or they look like they are completely buzzing with vitality. And, you know, you'll get like tiny chicks with their mouths open, and it's almost quite a sort of screaming representation of life. But there's not much in the middle where they're just sort of in repose. It's not the Victorian interpretation of taxidermy where you see them sort of sitting up on little chairs and drinking cups of tea. It's much more about life and, of course, sometimes death. And I've always found her work really arresting and really brilliant. And it was a complete joy to meet her and to speak to her. I'd never met her before. I'd only spoken to her on email when I bought one of her pictures for my husband for Christmas a few years back. And what that was a tiny little bird called a redpoll that sits on top of a frame. And inside the frame is a picture of a nest that is drawn using the ashes that's made from the remains, the sort of inside remains of that redpoll bird. So it's really quite beautiful, and it's in our hallway. And I'm very, very glad to own it. And I think she's great. And her story is really interesting. So over to Polly now. And if you're interested in what happened at the end of the construction site, they have now placed, the top layer of the car park with the massive crane. And everybody on the construction site, all the little dozers, which you'll recognise as the reference to Fraggle Rock, if you're of the same vintage as me, so all the guys working on the construction site seem pretty happy with the placement. So thumbs up for that, and thumbs up for this chat. See you on the other side. I'm excited to talk to you about lots of things. But also, I think I'm probably quite an unusual person to talk to you in that I have also done some taxidermy.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I did it with my family.
With your children, family, or your...
I would have done it with them, but this was quite a while ago. So, no, I did it with my... Actually, no, I think I was pregnant with one of them at the time. But yeah, I did it with my brother, my sister, my mum, and my husband. And we all... what's the past tense of taxidermy?
Well, I say taxidermied, but I don't think it's a word. I think you still say taxidermy, although that sounds a bit odd.
Okay, I taxidermy.
No, that doesn't work, does it? No. I performed taxidermy?
Yeah, I taxidermied a mouse. And
oh, not a good thing to start on.
Oh, really? Why would you? Fiddly.
I bet it went horrible, didn't it?
Some of them were really fiddly, spectacularly
funny. The bacteria grows very fast on mice, and they tend to do this thing called slipping when the fur just starts to sort of run off the skin
because it degrades. When we finish,
you still got it?
Oh, yeah.
I'm impressed. And the moths haven't eaten it.
You know what? I'm going to go and grab it. I think you need to give an assessment to my taxidermy skills.
Because I found them quite difficult to do.
It
wouldn't be something I'd recommend starting with. Although a lot of people do start on mice, I guess because they're small.
Hours doing these tiny little... So this is my one. So sitting on a chair reading a book about concise inorganic chemistry. Kick the heels off. What do you think of that?
I've seen far worse.
Thank you.
It's not bad, actually. I mean, it's not good either. But it's not bad. It's got a very small... Well, I suppose they have got small heads. The ears are so difficult. Did you turn them inside out? Do you remember that part or not?
So what I remember is making an incision, removing all the soft tissue.
Well, the body. You must have gone right around the whole body.
Right around the body.
Just taking that out.
Leaving pores, and then you have to take out the skull, and you have to clean the inside with certain things, and that's Richard's one. Richard's one is playing some music with, he's got some little vinyl. Such a funny thing, isn't it?
I think yours is slightly better. Sorry,
thanks,
Richard.
So do I. It's all right. I prefer
a lopsided face, this one.
I know.
Hammered. It's like... It's after a night out and he's falling against the record player.
He really is. Actually, it's basically us. We've made taxidermy versions of us. I've realised mine's got little high heels and it's just leaning into a record player after a few too many Negronis. we had to treat the inside and then wash the outside with, almost a washing up liquid and then fluff it up with a hairdryer. Mm-hmm. And then begin the process of reintroducing the stability that a spine would normally
provide. They don't look very stable, but...
There's a reason why mine's sitting down.
Yeah.
But it took 3.5 hours to...
That's very quick.
Is it?
Yeah, it would take longer than that. I mean, if you do it really properly, you should tan the skin over 3 days. But you can, I think there are... they've actually lasted really well. They must have been very fresh.
They were very fresh. I was thinking about... It is an art medium because obviously there's tons of craft involved in taxidermy and skill to be able to taxidermy something. But also you've got an element of your art that also might suggest things to you because of the fact that that animal is something that... Does it bring something? Does each animal bring its own thing to what you create?
Yes, definitely. I mean, right in the beginning, I mean, thinking about the stuff I first started working on, it was about, I was quite interested in working with animals that were overlooked, or at least the animals that we don't consider beautiful anymore because of the over-familiarity, like rats or pigeons, that kind of thing. So I kind of enjoyed trying to make people look at them afresh, I guess, and sort of to see the beauty in them. And they're like one of the first pieces I made was a rat kind of spilling out of the champagne bowl glass, and the woman who bought that said she hated rats but she found it really beautiful, so that was quite nice. But then since then I did start to kind of... It would be a question of just being donated things because everything dies naturally, so I just work with what I've been donated and kind of like playing around with them, like literally taking the bodies out and looking at them and the colours and the textures. And it's a lot about the juxtaposition of form and colour and texture for me. So I'm thinking about the work always as a sculpture as opposed to I'm not interested particularly in the kind of significance an animal might have in terms of its symbolism, or, you know, animals come with a lot of baggage. Like, we think foxes are sly and snakes are sort of evil, and so I always trying to kind of get away from that, remove the work from that as far as I possibly can, which is quite challenging.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're just saying you're working a lot with snakes now that you don't really like that much when they're alive. But
It's not that I don't like. I'm afraid of them. I think quite justifiably when they're alive.
Yes.
But they're incredible creatures.
So incredible. I mean,
and the more I've handled them, the more amazing they really are. They were the kind of perfect bridge for me into the new work that I'm doing, because it's much more about. I sort of see them like as a modelling material, really. They're like these long, thin tubes I can manipulate and make into different shapes and structures. And I tend to either use pieces of them kind of packed together to kind of represent flesh, or I tuck the heads right away. So very rarely will model the actual head of the snake. Because I kind of want to get away from that visceral reaction we have from them and the kind of snakiness of a snake. And I think the head's quite confrontational in a way. And I want to see them much more as form and colour and texture. So snakes have been perfect for doing that.
No, and I can see that absolutely what you mean, that when you don't think about them as the symbolism of the animal, but you just look literally at the form and, you know, on a snake, you've got the iridescence of the skin and actually how amazingly constructed. So much in nature that is just mind-blowing, that that's how something's evolved and how it exists. And
I know, it really is, yeah.
And the strength of it and how it would move and how you can shape it.
And just all of our references in pattern and textiles and our own, like nail design, all of these things, so much stuff comes from, I mean, it all comes from nature, really. You can kind of trace it all back to that. So I like to kind of juxtapose them with much more contemporary kind of takes on pattern and colour.
Yeah, no, I think all of that, I can totally understand that and see the beauty in all of that. And it's funny because I was thinking about when I was a child, and whenever I was, because like most people, people who don't grow up on farms, I'd say, my most normal way to interact with any animal that wasn't alive anymore was when it was making food. So, you know, you've got the whole chicken and things like this. And I was always really encouraged to not be at all squeamish, to actually kind of be quite impressed at the beauty of how things are formed. And I've never had any squeamishness about dealing with, you know, if I'm making something that has meat in it, I'm completely fine with that. And fish and all that. And if we ever buy a whole fish from the fishmonger, I'm always, you know, looking at it and showing the kids. And I've never had any awkwardness with that. And
I think you kind of inherit those things from parents. I think a lot of the time, if you've got the sort of parents who scream at you to back away from a dead animal if you find it as a child, or they're squeamish themselves about meat, and you tend to be kind of really divorced from that.
But you can disassociate, can't you?
Because
I was thinking, rather than asking you about why you're not squeamish, because actually I think that's, as you say, sort of maybe from learned thing, are you often surprised by how many people are squeamish?
Definitely, yeah. To begin with, I was a bit, absolutely. Most people are. And I never was, not even the first lesson. There are certain things I think are completely innate within us, like to be repelled by maggots, because I guess that's just we're primed to be repelled by maggots because they would indicate rotten flesh, and we don't want to eat rotten flesh because we might die. And I am disgusted by some of the smells, and if the animals have maggots, which sometimes happens. But generally, everything I work with has to be really fresh. So I've just always been way more fascinated and curious about learning about the animal or about the... It's amazing. I mean, just to get under the skin of something is a real... sounds weird, but it's a real kind of privilege, because we only really see... I don't know the exact percentage of the body that skin forms, but let's say 10-15%. And we never really see what goes on underneath that unless we're medical students. And I was never really particularly engaged with science at school because we never got to cut stuff up and never got to, like... I think you need a tactile experience sometimes, or a sensory experience, in order to learn stuff. I certainly did, I realised. I wasn't so good at sitting and just listening to people talking and writing on blackboards. It was only when I actually got to kind of touch and feel and smell and associate some sort of memory with something that I would learn.
Yeah, and I suppose, like you say, of everything being influenced by nature, there's a real poetry in all of that as well, I think, in terms of the cycle of everything and, as you say, what's going on beneath the surface and how everything's moving. And does it affect your relationship with your own body when you're exploring that?
It's made me want to be more fit, definitely.
Really?
I've had moments where I remember skinning a fox once. It was a young fox, an adult, but a young adult, had been hit by a car. And it was beautiful. And under the skin, it was just so beautiful. It was like, it was so lean and the muscles. And I just, because it was so, so fresh, the meat was really pink. And I was just really struck by its, because if you, when you're skinning an older animal, sometimes there's sort of fatty deposits and things are sort of like degrading a little bit. And it was just, it made me, definitely made me think about that, about my own, like, I was, about what went on under my skin and like whether I was kind of looking after that part. Because we spend so long, like a lot of my work, the themes behind my work is a lot to do with veneers and about kind of surface and reality and about what we, how we go about, we put filters on our faces on social media and all of those sorts of things. And it's all about kind of deception, really. But it make me, it definitely makes me think much more about looking after the kind of reality, the body, than like not worrying too much about what's going on the outside, which is all just trickery, really.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I suppose, especially when you're aware of that sort of percentage of what, that's only such a small part of who we are and what forms us. And yeah,
it's kind of a shortcut, because we're just, we look in the mirror and we think, okay, we look good today. We've done our makeup or our hair and we feel better about it. But it definitely makes me think more about the whole thing, the whole organism.
Yeah, and I suppose I was listening to an interview where you were saying that actually your work is sometimes, but quite rarely, about death, and just because it involves a dead animal is actually not really...
Yeah, I would say, I mean, right in the beginning, I definitely didn't... I think I didn't do enough to distance the work from death, but it wasn't as dead. There's always been this real... Certainly in the beginning, maybe less so now, but, yeah, I felt like people made this fundamental mistake about, well, about me, certainly, that I was kind of morbid or I was into death in some way. I mean, I hate death as much as the next person. I'm terrified of it. But it's a logistical fact. The animal has to die in order for me to work on it. That's all. It's just another material, really. I can't, I'm not going to start skinning live animals. So, yeah, I used to say, you know, you wouldn't say that a charcoal drawing is about death because it's burnt, it's dead wood. So it's just, I mean, I understand if you're constructing it to look like a dead animal, of course, that's good. It's going to come into people's minds. But it was about a lot more than that, and more actually about life, I think, for me.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I suppose some of those ideas probably come from the era when taxidermy is quite associated with, like, Victorian times. And that was an era that was very obsessed with the taboo of death and how to handle that. And they did the anthropomorphizing of the... went with taxidermy to make them look like little people. It's actually quite peculiar.
Like, but you're like,
I know,
mice.
Like mine. I know. Yeah. Well, yeah, hopefully I have a bit more of a sense of... Actually, no, I suppose they thought they... Maybe they did think their ones were funny too, the Victorians.
Well, cause, yeah, I think... I mean, the most famous one is Walter Potter, who, and I think they definitely were supposed to be some humour in them and some eccentricity to it.
Yeah, you're right. There's eccentricity, actually. That's a really good word for it. I mean, when you're doing something like, you know, with taxidermy, does it, do you feel like connected in a way to these people that have gone before? This was the line you're following.
Not really.
No.
No, well, because I always hesitate. Whenever I make the distinction between myself and taxidermist and say I'm an artist, I feel like I'm being kind of snobby, but it's not meant like that at all. It's more, it's kind of out of respect for them in a way, because I think as a taxidermist, you spend years trying to make your animal look as lifelike as possible, and that's not what I do. I mean, I chop snakes up in the studio and I use the bits of them to form bigger sculptures. And so I think it's much more about a full sculpture for me. I do lots of moulding and casting of other objects. So I don't actually know. I'm much more likely to sort of look at other artists and think of myself in the kind of art lineage, I think, than in taxidermy. Although, I guess, I mean, I definitely have a place in the taxidermy world. And I think it was more that I was looking at taxidermy and I liked it, but at the same time, it wasn't being displayed in the way that I would have displayed it. This is how I kind of got into it in the first place. I didn't really want to own it particularly. I wasn't really interested in having a cabinet where you mimic the natural environment of the animal, which is just sort of like a three-dimensional photograph to me. I kind of wanted to... I thought as a medium, it was very untapped. If you think about photography or painting and how there's so many different styles, with taxidermy there wasn't really that. So it was really like more of a springboard for me to make sculpture.
Exactly, sculpture is exactly it. And so you've now got a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, is that right?
Yes,
And so you were saying before we started recording that you've been working in the basement of your house.
Yes.
Was that the case before lockdown as well?
It was actually, no. It has been my studio since I was pregnant with the first one. Since he was born, I had a studio during my pregnancy. And I say it's the basement. It's a great space. We live in an old pub, so it's the beer cellar.
Amazing.
And it's not, we've done up lots of the building, but the basement is the last sort of untouched bit, which is very much a beer cellar still. It's like concrete floors, very low hanging ceiling. Luckily, I'm not too tall, but a lot of my visitors whack their heads on pipes and things when they come down. There's no natural light. It's cold, but it's actually a good space to make a mess because I do make a lot of mess down there with the, mostly with the moulding and casting, actually, but also, like, sometimes if I'm chopping things up or...
Is it just quite a private space, or do the kids come down?
Yeah, no, it's good. That's the other good thing about it. It's got a lockable door at the top. I don't normally lock it, but they don't really come down. I mean, it's kind of dirty and cold and dusty, and they're one of the older ones a little bit more intrigued, so I'll bring him down sometimes, but it's full of really dangerous things as well, so I can lock it. So it's perfect. And it was meant to be temporary, but then actually it just kind of is so much easier when you've got young kids and the idea of traveling to and from a studio and losing like precious hour or whatever it might be in commuting is just wasn't really feasible. So it's been a really useful thing. And particularly I was really lucky through the first lockdown when we really weren't allowed to go anywhere. It was great because my boyfriend's an artist too, and he'd been traveling a lot before that. So suddenly he was grounded, which was brilliant for me because it meant he had to like split the childcare. And we would just take it in turns to work. So one of us would have the kids and the other one would go down. He works mainly on a computer, but he'd be in the office or I'd be in the basement. So it really came into its own at that point. However, I do love leaving the house because I don't get to do that very often. So I jumped at the opportunity to come here.
And how good are you with the sort of discipline of that? If you're finding that you're, you know, was it very obvious to you how you still prioritise your need to make work? Or did you sometimes feel a bit torn with the kids around all the time?
Do you mean specifically lockdown?
I suppose a bit of that. And also generally. Because I know that that's something I struggle with when I'm home.
Yeah, it is tricky. It's been a lot easier since everything's gone back to normal. One of them's in full-time nursery and the other's at school. So I get very specific hours now that I work in. And because I know they're finite, I tend to be quite productive in those hours.
Yes.
During the whole lockdown, I mean, everything was just like a mess for the beginning. I was just kind of winging it for the first week or so. And then I realized that we had to be really structured about it if it was going to work. So I timetabled everyone and we all had our kind of like, what I would be with Clifford at this point and Matt would be doing something with Bruce. Then we'd have them on our own and then he'd go and work and then I'd work. And it worked really well like that. I think they you know, kids are very conservative. They thrive in structure, I think. So it kind of worked well for us all in the end. But you're always torn about stuff like that, aren't you, about working from home. And I try really hard to make sure that the time that they're home, that we have together, is ours. I'm not yet on top of my phone usage. I still find myself staring at that sometimes when they're talking to me and I'd like to do something about that.
Yeah, it's quite hard all that, especially if your phone is basically your office.
Exactly, yeah. And there's no one else answering the emails, so you kind of feel like you should check them. But they're lucky because we both work from home and they see us a lot. If I think about their friends, who a lot of whom are in after school clubs and breakfast clubs and have nannies pick them up and things like that, they probably see a lot more of us than they would, I think, if we were actually going into an office or a studio far away. So I think overall they've got a fairly good deal.
Yeah, they'd love having you working from... And my kids would love it if I was here like that, working from home. I think they find it really, even if I'm not in the same room, just reassuring.
Exactly. I think just knowing you're around, exactly. Because, yeah. I mean, we have the occasional nanny and things coming through and helping out, but... the fact that we're there, I think, really helps. And you get them up and you put them to bed.
Exactly. Yeah, that continuity is really good for small people. They like that a lot. And I know that the last couple of months when I've been more working at sort of normal pace, I've had a lot of complaints from my older kids, especially about the fact that I don't have a job where I'm just not going away as much and not out as much, which is quite tough. So I've kind of gone back to that. I think they had, 18 months of not really applying.
Yeah.
But...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot.
we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I do wonder what it must be like when you've got small kids and you're introducing them to your work and you're an artist, and obviously there's a lot of your work that's really conceptual. And has it been interesting seeing it through their eyes, being introduced to the things that you're sort of fueled by and driven by?
It's starting. I mean, they're still quite young. The elder one, but that, having said that, I think the elder one, I don't like to say this, I don't like to kind of make assumptions on them too quickly about what they're into and what they're not into. However, it seems that the eldest one is going to be more creative than the younger one. He's certainly always been really into drawing and making stuff, and he asks so many questions about our work. Whereas Bruce, the three-year-old, is totally disinterested in anything really that we do. He's never, I mean, it's so funny. If I think about when Clifford was three, he would ask about the snakes. He would come down and look in the freezers. He would just say things like, wow, this is a really beautiful one you've made here, Mum. And like, whereas the other, I don't even know if you, I don't think Bruce really knows what I get up to at all down there, and he's not interested in any way. But I mean, it's, I think I'm going to go through a period. This, my prediction is that I'll go through a little sweet spot with them where they think I'm quite cool, and then they'll suddenly realise how weird I am, and they'll be really embarrassed about everything.
That's actually more fun than you think, though, when you get to that point.
Oh, really? Then you can embarrass them.
I've been reveling in that space for a little while now. I quite like it, if I'm honest. And actually, broadly speaking, I have a very similar dynamic with my my eldest two, in that the first one was always a lot more interested in what Richard and I get up to, and the next one down.
Maybe they're more interested in the older child. Maybe that's it.
Yeah, that might be it.
They're looking to you, and then the second one's looking to their brother.
Yeah, and I think also kids are quite clever at, well, this is just, you know, from what I've seen, they're quite clever at seeing what's gone before and kind of doing the opposite.
Yes.
Because that's a gap in the market.
Yeah.
So
that's definitely been the case of mine.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's a sort of
it's a way of standing out, I guess,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, okay, has anyone taken
has anyone
up that
done
space?
This?
Yeah, that'll be my area. So yeah, I think, and I quite enjoy both aspects of that. Actually, I like the fact that I can have lots of chats with my eldest about things, and then, I love the fact that Kit's completely disinterested in 90% work, and I don't think he's even that bothered about a lot of like music in general, really. But I do think
it's very refreshing that.
Yeah, it's fun, and also like you're sort of rooting for them in a weird way. Like, okay, yeah, be your own person. That's all good. And I think there's the big sort of headline, I think, actually, is that it's really, I like raising a family in a really creative environment, because I think it's a nice space to grow up in your childhood, if kind of anything goes, really, so long as you're expressing yourself, it's all good. So I think there's lots of benefits for that that I'm sure.
Well, and also you're just kind of bringing in loads of different examples of ways to live, I think, as well, and they get to see that. We don't go out very much, but we bring people into the house a lot of the time. So we have various people. Sometimes we'll just live with us for a while because we have a spare room. So people we really like, who might, maybe younger people who might need somewhere to live, or maybe we'll do a bit of work in the studio in lieu of rent. Think that we just kind of get them into the house.
What other creatives, like artists?
Yeah, we've had both. We've had an artist and another, the guy's living with us at the moment is an actor and a actor and builder.
Ah, that's very handy.
It is.
can talk about theatre and he can.
And I often I will offer free studio space to younger artists that I like for periods of times, and they just, because I just really like having company when I'm working. Mm. So there's just lots of different types of people coming and going, and I think that you don't have to foist them on your children, but it's just nice that they get to witness that, I think.
Definitely. No, I actually sounds quite similar to my own upbringing as well. My mum would have lodgers quite often, and I think it's quite healthy to encourage curiosity about other people, actually, and ask questions and hear about other lives. And that's probably why I've ended up doing this podcast, so that I get to do it legitimately. So it's been really, I think that doesn't leave you, actually. It's interesting you say you like to work with other people, given that that's probably something that's not the normal thing. Or is it, do you often find there's someone alongside you?
I mean, at the moment, I haven't got anyone down there. But no, I mean, I didn't miss it at the beginning at all, because I've worked throughout university in like my early 20s. I was working in a bar. I sort of started as a glass collector and just worked my way up to managing the bar. And then when I graduated, they just offered me this position, and I didn't really want to go and work in an office. So I did that for a bit, and that was really, really social. And it was really good for me at that time, because I was quite shy when I came to London, and it just completely knocked that out of me. Having to like kick people, drunk men out at 2 a.m. from a bar, it kind of tends to make you a bit more confident.
Mm.
And then I just kind of became an artist, and suddenly I'd gone from that to just working on my own. And I liked it. I think as an antidote, it was really nice just to be able to be in control of my own time and my own space. But then I just got to a point where I suddenly realized that I felt really like I was missing out on. You miss out a lot on friendships, because some of the strongest friendships that you have, or most people have in life, come out of working with people, like colleagues. When else do you kind of get a chance to really intimately get to know someone, unless you're dating them or they're your family? It doesn't really work that way. And I just didn't have that. I didn't really have a core of people. I had lots of sort of random friends, some of whom would know each other. And I sort of have got a little group of friends-ish now. Sometimes we'll go on holiday together, or we kind of make an effort to hang out. But they're all pretty sort of disparate and random, and I've had to kind of work on that myself. So I realised that if you want that, you have to kind of make it happen yourself. So I would take interns when I was younger and a bit busier. I would sometimes I had like 3 or 4 interns for busy periods, and they were like some of the happiest working times. We'd all cook for each other, and there was a real kind of camaraderie about it.
Mm.
So now, yeah, I just have to kind of lure people in somehow.
Well, I can see that. I totally agree with you, that whole thing of being able to see everybody every day and get that camaraderie going. And it's actually, you get that momentum as well. It's like an enthusiasm. Because I think when you're an artist and your own cheerleader, I imagine it all falls on your shoulders to be motivated for the next project.
Well, also just making every decision myself, I find really, really exhausting and boring. And I mean, I still have to do it, but it's still nice if you have someone that you can kind of bounce ideas off, at least. And also just working in a vacuum, I don't think it's healthy. You're not really going to progress far. You need to be witnessing someone else, maybe working on something else, maybe using different materials, or somehow all of those things just kind of have, you know, maybe just the tiniest influence that will set you off on a slightly different course. And I found it's really worked. It's been very productive doing that.
Do you think there's quite a lot of mystery for most people about how it is to live as an artist?
I don't know, probably. I mean, I do mostly hang out with other artists or people in that kind of world, so it's not something that occurred to me. But it does, yeah, I get a lot of questions asked of me when people know. I kind of feel like I'm quite fortunate in that way, in that it's like a conversation starter when I talk about what I do, like, you know, maybe at the school gates or something. People are curious, so they want to know more, whereas if someone tells me they work in, like, IT or something, I just don't know what to say from there on, because recruitment or something. And I'm sure they've got these great jobs and they must be very interesting in their own ways. But it more throws a light on how little I know about stuff like that. So someone said they worked in mergers and acquisitions, and I was like, oh, that sounds amazing. And I just thought, it kind of shuts me down.
Have you had any good acquisitions recently? Merged anything fun?
Whereas I think if you say, particularly the taxidermy element, but also just as an artist, I think people, they're curious. They want to see where you work in the space and the materials and stuff. And
well, I'd imagine there's maybe more curiosity than most artists would experience when you say the medium you work
Definitely
in.
Definitely the medium, yeah.
And what's the most common response you get to people?
Where do you get your animals from?
Where do you get your animals?
Almost straight away in a slightly hostile way until I answer, and then they kind of soften when
holding
onto
the dog lead a little bit.
They wait, so they want to know quite how to respond to me, and depending on my answer, And as soon as I've cleared that up, generally they soften and then they ask. I get this literally, I used to joke about having a T-shirt printed up with about five bullet points on, just answering all of those questions. Because one would be, what's the most amazing animal you've ever stuffed? What would be your kind of ultimate? Would you ever stuff a human? That would always come up quite high.
I wouldn't even thought to ask that.
I always get that one. There's four or five stock questions, which is fine. I understand. I'm sure I do the same thing to other people.
Yeah, well, I think, yeah, and the curiosity is quite fun, but I think, yeah, the idea of, like, just standing at the school getting a cat wanders past and you're stroking it.
Yeah, I know, yeah, people always do that. Yeah, they get a lot of jokes about people's pets.
Exactly. Well, yeah. And going back with your babies, I often ask people what was going on in their life when they had their first baby, but I know that the route to being a mother was a bit more complicated for you. So you found yourself, is it 31 that you had the appendicitis?
Or was you've done research. I think I was 31, yeah. I think it was exactly then, yeah.
So was that the point you were also starting to try for a baby?
It was just before, I think it was 32 that I started actually thinking about really trying. But it's something we talked about and we knew was kind of imminent. And then...
So you'd always wanted to be a mum one
day? I had. And I'd been quite firm with my boyfriend's quite a bit older. He's now 55 and he had a child when he was 23. He's also now a father. He's 31 now. Wow. Yeah, so he's a grandpa. And so I had said, I think we'd been together for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years when I was about 30. And I'd said, you know, by the way, if this is going to continue, this is what has to happen. And he kind of was always a bit like, yeah, soon. But you're quite old, you know, you don't want to be a really old father. So we kind of agreed it would happen quite soon. And then we went on safari to the Serengeti on this trip that I really wanted to do. And then it's the day after we got back, I got really sick. And I thought I'd got food poisoning because we'd been to a fish market in Zanzibar just before we left. So I stupidly kept telling the doctors in the hospital, I just got back from Zanzibar, I was at a fish market, and they said, oh yeah, well, it's very likely to be that then. So they kept sending me home, but it kept getting worse and worse, and I kept going back in, and then I'd get sent back again. And then after a couple of days, my appendix actually burst, and I was really ill, and I had peritonitis, and I went into hospital in an ambulance in the end, but still, it took them a long time. It was a bank holiday, it was a Friday of a bank holiday, which is the worst time, I think, to be admitted. So I didn't even get a scan until the following day, and I was like a death's door at that point.
Oh, you're lucky you didn't.
And then
die.
I know I was. It was very close, I think. I only really realised that looking back, but I was so out of it at the time. Anyway,
you must have been a lot of pain. That's not just
no.
It was, that must have been agony.
It was. Oh my God. Then I did childbirth, so I don't know. I thought it was the worst pain. Anyway, then I'm. Long story short, after a couple of, I think I started trying for a baby a year after, and I didn't make the connection with the appendicitis for ages, but I just wasn't getting pregnant, and I kept going to the doctor, and she sort of insisted that I just wasn't trying hard enough. And it was only, my friend Kim said to me, did you not think it might be something to do with the appendix? And I Googled it, and first thing that came up was like one of the complications can be blocked fallopian tubes.
Wow.
So I went back to the doctor with it.
Is pretty perceptive.
She was great. It was brilliant because I'd been to the doctor loads of times and she'd never come up. And I'd even mentioned the appendix to her. Anyway, so yes, it turned out as soon as I finally got referred, I had this thing called hydrosalpinx, which is when your fallopian tubes are blocked. So I had to have them removed and do IVF to have the children. And that was... What I thought at the time, for the first one, for Clifford, I found it, the actual IVF part, the jabbing yourself with the needles and all of that, and the side effects of the drugs weren't really the problem for me. But it's when you, I mean, anyone who's had IVF and failed will know, but the failure of the rounds is what's really devastating. And so I failed two, and then on the third one, we ended up doing this thing called genetic screening, where it really, it's just a way of kind of avoiding unnecessary miscarriages, basically, because a lot of the time you will have a clutch of embryos and some of them will be abnormal, but they won't be able to tell just by looking at them.
Okay.
And others aren't. So they will put one inside you and then quite often you might test pregnant and then you're just never going to, it's never going to make a baby. So we did that on the second one. Turned out that there was, I had seven embryos, I think, and all of them were duds, basically. It came back that not one of them would have made a baby. So that was a real blow. But in hindsight, a great thing for me, because, I mean, that's a potential 7 miscarriages that I avoided by doing that. And then the third one, we did it again, and we had one good embryo, and that was my first son. And then after that, I did another round for Bruce, and it was successful the first time. And honestly, doing it again once you have a child is a completely different thing, because you just... It's just the difference. I think the really difficult thing when you haven't got children and you're trying for a child is that constant worry that you're never going to be a mother. Once you're a mother, it's more a worry of, like, maybe they won't have a sibling, which wouldn't have been for me as devastating, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's a very... I know that when my mum was trying to have a baby after my sister, she said she found it really tough because she felt like she knew what she was missing out on. And that for her, that was she felt like that was really hard. But I don't...
Well, if she hadn't had another...
Yeah, which she didn't in the end. Yeah, she had a lot of miscarriages and didn't end up having that baby. But that's what she said to me, like,
right,
when we spoke about it.
Yeah.
But I suppose, yeah, there's a lot to take in from what you've just said. And I'm wondering what it felt like at the beginning when you found out that the appendicitis had meant that actually getting pregnant naturally was just not an option. That's a really big deal, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I mean, I felt there was a sense of relief to have it confirmed at the beginning. But then, I mean, it's difficult. I don't want to start knocking any of the people involved, but it was I was really unlucky. There was like a massive catalogue of failings that kind of got me in that position in the first place. It shouldn't have got to that point at all. And I did feel quite... I felt quite pissed off that I'd been kind of let down by lots of people, because I felt like I was... And my boyfriend confirmed this. He said he witnessed this happening on several occasions. I really felt like I was just being treated like a bit of a hysterical blonde a few times, like when I was going. Like, they really just didn't seem to take it seriously enough, any of it. Like when I went to the hospital, when I was on the phone to NHS Direct, I was given completely inaccurate advice, which a doctor since told me is complete nonsense. So there was lots of things that kind of went wrong. So I did feel a little bit cross for a while, but I was very galvanized to get on with it. There was the waiting list was really long. So that was another blow. It was like 10 months and I'd already been waiting long enough. Yeah. And I just, So we decided that we'd try and get the money together to do it privately, which we did. And I'd been recommended this place that was supposed to be the place to go. And that was, it was horrible. I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. It was kind of like it was a bit Handmaid's Tale, the way they kind of lined all the women up in beds and stuck cannulas in their arm. They were very driven by results, I think, rather than thinking about the human experience. But then the second, I found a doctor for the second or third ones who was great. I don't know. I mean, it's now I look back on it, I think I was so lucky. It was just, you do feel it while you're going through it, you feel a bit of a victim, I suppose. I remember reading about a woman who'd had exactly the same experience as me. And she was suing the NHS because she was now in her 40s and she'd had lots of failed rounds of IVF. And it was exactly the same thing. I mean, word for word, it had burst and lots of complications. And I think one of the hospitals had admitted fault. And so I had this like background terror that would be me in a few years' time and that it just actually wouldn't happen. And I looked into adoption, and adoption is, you know, anyone who just says, oh, just adopt. I always get so frustrated when I hear or read that if someone's trying for a baby and they go, oh, why don't you just adopt? There's loads of children out there who need a home. A, there aren't, actually, not in this country anyway. And B, it's a really grueling process in itself, and you can't even begin it until you... And I think they make you wait, I think it's a year or 2 years after IVF before they'll even begin to consider you, because they say you need to grieve from that process.
Wow, I actually didn't know that.
No, so all of these things kind of become apparent when you look into it. And then you can potentially adopt from overseas, because overseas there are children who need homes, but then that's politically fraught, because there's a lot of... It's all to do with the... Whether or not you can adopt from certain countries comes down to their relationship with the UK government, which is always changing.
Oh, wow.
There's like, I think probably in terms of letdowns, it's probably far worse than IVF, actually, I would think. And then, of course, so many children who were adopted have been in the kind of care system for years, and you're going to have like a... I felt that if I adopted, I would have to probably give up work, because you have to love them in a whole different way, I think, and you have to look after them really differently. So that was a fear as well, because I didn't want to give up work.
Yeah, I can understand it. Well, I know as well that even once you start the adoption process, that's on average like a couple of years, I think. And
yeah,
also you can be turned down at the end.
You can
of
be
that.
Turned down, yeah, you
so
can.
So I do, I've heard...
I know a perfectly reasonable woman
story.
Who was turned down for, I don't know, I don't understand why. You know, I spoke to a few people. I went and had a meeting with this woman who advises other people in it now that she's done it. And she said, you know, you have to be prepared. They will come and they will, like, with a fine tooth comb, yeah, go over your house. They will look at the pictures on your walls, and if you've got nudes on the walls, they might say that's inappropriate. Should they found cat poo in my garden and said that, you know, that I couldn't possibly allow this to happen with a baby. Should A, I didn't even have a baby at that point, and B, you know, my cat had just done a poo, and I, you know, yeah, they'd come round at 10 o'clock in the evening. So, you know, you don't have to go through anything like that when you have a child conceived naturally. Yeah. So, yeah, it's tough. But anyway, now what I'm trying to say is I know now that I'm a mother how fortunate I was, because I have... I mean, anyone who's had IVF will probably be in this position. You become like a go-to person for other women going through it. And so I anyone who vaguely knew me or who knew someone who knew me would get in touch when they were going through it, because I was always really keen to talk to and advise people, because... it's really bewildering when it happens to you. You don't know where to look. There's loads of people kind of selling the whole dream to you, and it's really difficult to know what to do next. And I felt something of an expert of it by the time I finished, because I'd done so much reading about it. And I have met so many women since who have like had far, far more. In fact, one friend had 17 failed rounds of IVF. And she just couldn't stop going. And I totally understand that, because the only thing that kept me from being in a depression was I would be depressed after each failed one. And then the idea of continuing would be the only thing that would kind of lift you out of it would be that sudden decision. OK, I'm going to do it again. And then you could start living again because you had home. And she's 17. And she was her 17th, she'd said, was absolutely her final one. She's now pregnant and she's having her baby on Saturday. I know. So I look at things like, I mean, and oh, I can't tell you how happy, I mean, I like even want to cry just thinking about it. But things you become really, really invested in other women going through it.
Oh, did you have that person for you when you were going through it? The person you called?
I had a few people. I met some amazing women. I sat next to someone at a dinner once who I'd never met before. And she was just so sweet. She had tried and failed, and she'd accepted it and moved on and was really happy in her marriage. And she was very cool. I think about her a lot. I bump into her sometimes still, but she, because she was a great example of someone who said, okay, this is enough. And just like, and I don't know how you, I don't, I would have really struggled to reach that point, I think. She was great.
It's a personal thing all around, isn't it? The whole thing of it, your relationship with all of it, with how you think of yourself as a mother before, whether or not you plan to be a mum, what kind of a mum you end up being if you're lucky enough to have kids. And yeah, your relationship with your own fertility, how many children you'd like to, all of it is so, it's so personal, and a lot of it isn't completely out of our hands.
When it comes to infertility or like problems, fertility problems, it's totally out of your hands. And that's what's so frustrating about it, I think. Because a lot of the women, I know certainly for me and a lot of the women I spoke to, you know, they're kind of driven, successful people who've kind of put everything in place. They're working really hard. And then there's this one thing that they just can't make it happen anyway. Mm. It doesn't, obviously, they're, you know, if you're lucky enough to be able to get the money to keep going, and that's what it comes down to eventually. But, you know, even for those people who managed to do 17, it's a question of like selling houses and things sometimes.
Yeah.
But generally, if you keep going, you are much more likely to get there, because it's like a lucky dip. You've got so many eggs, and some of them are going to work and some aren't, and you have to just keep going back in. But at the same time, it's also like gambling, because you get really addicted to the hope, and there is a chance that you could lose hundreds of thousands of pounds and come out without a baby and feeling completely,
yeah. And there's
like
also some people where they've
twice.
Been through the process, and then actually I spoke to a woman her husband actually had quite bad postnatal depression after waiting 7 years for their baby, and then
wow.
Because there's lots along the way that's really isolating, and you can have lots of people around you that are really good for support. But I think there's lots about the process of all, you know, whether it's IVF or not, actually. I think just being a, finding yourself responsible for a small human that's very vulnerable is scary.
Yeah, and then I think so if you've had IVF, there's this weird added thing when the baby arrives. Partly there's an anxiety. And I'm sure all new mothers are anxious about their baby, but I feel like it may be slightly heightened because you've always, you spent your whole pregnancy terrified you're going to lose it, and then the baby's here, and then you're terrified he's going to get sick or something.
Yes.
But the other thing is there's this weird sort of added layer of guilt, because you just think, if you want to go back to work, you know, but I've wanted this child so much, you know, I've like tried so hard. Should I be leaving them for a day or an hour, or should I be going and having a night on my own somewhere? You start to feel this weird, or if you're finding it really overwhelming and stressful, or maybe if you have depression, you kind of feel extra guilty, like you tried so hard and now you're kind of, you're struggling with it. You don't ever want to complain about anything.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. And I think that's probably why I like having this conversation with lots of different people, because I think those themes run through most mothers' minds. You know, that's just part and parcel of it. And I find chatting to people about it really helpful, because I think it was probably in part motivated by my own guilt and how I've tried to balance doing the thing that I love, but also feeling like I'm a good mum. Because I think on my, you know, on my deathbed, the thing I would like is my legacy is just being a good parent would be number one on the list, I think. Did you find your relationship with your work did change once you were a mother?
Yeah, it did, definitely. But I think, to begin with, definitely it really helped. I'd had this really protracted period of, like, I guess I call it like artist's block, where I wasn't really happy with the work that I was making, and I felt I just couldn't really find a way out of the work that I'd been doing into the work that I wanted to be making. And it was, maybe it was sort of tied in with the fertility thing. Because I continued to work through all of that, but I think it was a bit joyless. Particularly is that it wasn't the thing that I wanted the most, which was to be a mother. But then, once I did have a child, I did find, after 3 months, we had a part-time nanny, and I would work maybe 3 short days a week. And I just felt it was just so nice to, having had that length of time not working, maybe I just needed a break from it all. But also I think it's when you've got this very limited time, you don't really mess around. I think I've spent too much time thinking and not enough doing for a period, maybe. And I just thought, well, I've only got this long, so I better just crack on with something. And that really helped. And that was in the beginning. But then it did definitely, there was a quiet period with my work with when the children were young, which was fine. And I very much chose that at the beginning. I thought, well, now is the time. I'm going to be a mother. I'm not going to stop working altogether, but I don't care as much about that and about the success I may be having. And so I started to sort of turn a few things down. I stopped really going out socially much. And that, it was all fine to begin with. But then you suddenly realize that because you've done all of that, people are kind of forgetting who you are, and you're not getting the requests to do things as much as you used to, and you start to actually miss that a little bit. And once it's gone, it's kind of harder to start to kind of get that going again. So I did make a very kind of conscious decision to just get on with the work and to get to my second son into full-time childcare as soon as I could, so that I could actually, I put on a show during lockdown, and it was really important that I did that, even though it was the worst possible time in the end to do it, because I mean, I'd have all these people saying, oh, it's amazing with all this extra time. I'm learning a language. What are you doing with the extra time? So, well, I've got half the time I had before because the children are at home the whole time. But somehow I did do it, and it went really well. And it just springboarded loads of other stuff that's happened as a consequence. And I feel like I'm getting back into that now. But it's just peaks and troughs, you know. I think you just have to accept that that's the way it is. And I, like you, I think that whenever I'm feeling really frustrated about it, I stop and think, come on, but what is more important? They're growing up really quickly. I'm going to look back on this time, and do I want to have just thought that I was in the studio the whole time, or do I want to think that I was there with them? Because all of that stuff can come back again. I can do that later.
Yeah, and I suppose, it's, you know, so long as you're getting enough of what you need to feel like you in the equation as well, I think it's really important to still I do think being a little bit selfish about it is quite
you
good.
Need, well, you're just a better mum as a result, I think. Yeah. You're so much, I'm so much nicer to them when I've had a day at work. I have, and then over the holidays, I worked very little and I was mostly with them for the 6 week summer break. And I was, by the end of it, I was getting so ratty with them and like just shrieky. And I just thought, God, I'm not being very kind to them. I just need a couple of hours. And so every now and then, if I got the chance, I'd take a couple of hours just to go and like catch up on emails and things. And I'd come back and I'd be sitting down and playing with them again. And, you know, yeah, they appreciate that.
Definitely. One thing I did want to touch on, actually, when I was reading an article you about when you were going through IVF. And I think you made a point that really resonated with me about the forums online where women are talking about pregnancy,
yeah,
and how a lot of it is quite infantilized in, yeah, terms of the language, mm-hmm, and little emoticons and stuff.
Yeah.
And I was laughing because you were saying there's lots of anachronisms, like they said
BD, baby dons, which is having sex.
Which is just outrageous. But there's loads of them, aren't there? And I remember, is it DH, awful, like darling husband?
DH, and then DS, darling son, DD, darling daughter, everything's. Yeah. But then, I mean, and then they would any kind of miscarriages would be kind of talked about with like a little angel with wings, and it was all,
yeah, and wishing you baby dust and all of that,
baby sprinkling baby dust on you. Yeah, that was the other one.
I do wonder where that comes from, actually. That way that I've noticed that when the times when I've ventured towards those forums, maybe when I've been thinking about having another baby, or I've been in the early stage of pregnancy, I want to check something seems, you know, normal.
Yeah,
and you find yourself in these
places. Yourself reading them a lot. When you,
yeah,
just, they can be very helpful when you
and
want
also
to find out.
You're thinking, I want to know what happened next to that person. Did they end up having the baby? What happened? but there is a lot of it that's done in this very sort of soft, childlike language, and I don't know what that's about, really. I wonder if it's protecting yourself a little bit.
Yeah, possibly. Or,
well, not wanting to offend other people, maybe.
I think it's partly that. Like, they want to make sure that they're always... I mean, there's a lot of kindness between these women, and I think it's great. You know, there's a lot of support. Some people on there clearly really are probably lacking support elsewhere, and a lot of them do. You know, you notice that they're checking in on people and saying, how are you and how's it going? And so they've got a really... And I didn't post on them, but I used to read them loads because I got a lot of information out of it. So they were very helpful. I didn't really want to knock them, but I did think, like, what? Where's the kind of straightforward discussion about this? And I think this might have changed a bit since I wrote about that. But I found that, so I would go into these IVF waiting rooms and we were all in the same boat. And then there's also, you'd think there should be. And there was sometimes you'd notice a couple of people that sort of buddied up, but you think really we should all be kind of here supporting each other, talking about this, and yet everyone would just be like looking at their phones. I would be Googling, like, you know, what happens when you've got this blood count, well, whatever it might be, and just reading about it rather than like looking up and talking to anyone around me. There was also a weird sort of sense almost of like, I think there was like a strange competitive thing because some of us, we knew that some of us in the room would get pregnant and some of us wouldn't.
Yeah.
So there was that strange, almost kind of furtive looks up at each other.
And yeah,
I just found the whole situation really strange the first time around, actually. Because then you'd go online and you'd get all this really cozy language between women, and yet in reality we were all sitting side by side,
yeah,
completely ignoring each other.
Maybe a worry as well that if you talk about it openly that it's going to somehow sort of tempt fate.
Jinx it.
It's going to go wrong, yeah.
Yeah. Or it could just be the fact that the kind of women who post on those forums,
yeah, they like,
you know,
like
to talk like that, you know, because I wouldn't
really
have spoken like that and I never posted, so
it's
it could
true,
just
yeah,
have been that.
Weighed in with your grown-up,
yeah,
language.
Exactly. Have been chased off.
And are you the sort of mother you thought you would be, do you think? It's quite hard to know.
Ooh,
sometimes.
That's an interesting question. I never really thought about that. I think I'm a little bit slightly better than I thought I would be, maybe, but not.
It's hard to know.
Yeah, that's tricky. I the reason I'm saying that was because I've got an older sister she's like the model mother. She had children in her 20s. She's got three children. She took quite a long period away from work and did. You know, she's never had a nanny. Not to say I'm not knocking women who have nannies, but she chose to do everything. And she did everything and she did it really well. And she would sit and she would make things with them and do cards. And I just look at her and think, she's like an alien species to me. I have no idea how she can do that. Because I'd spend 5 minutes with her kids and have to go and lie down. I found it so exhausting. So I did always think, we're so different and we'll do it really, really differently. But I think I was underestimating the fact that when they're your children, you do get a lot more pleasure out of doing those things with them than you would if you were teaching other people in the nursery or something.
Mm.
She is still definitely an infinitely more patient and present mother than I have been. But I have definitely found so much joy in, like, I used to look at the baby groups and things. I'd walk into galleries and there'd be women sitting on a mat with toys and babies doing stuff, and I think, oh God, I couldn't do that.
Mm.
Or I'd go, or the whole NCT thing, I think, I don't know if I can do that. And I did all of it and I loved it. And I, you know, I've got a group of great friends that I made out of NCT. We still text, I mean, literally every day we probably text each other now.
Oh,
and that
nice.
Was after over 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and I did all of those gallery type things. And when you sit on a mat with your baby and you kind of interact with them, and I just didn't appreciate how different it is when you've got this little person of your own and you suddenly. It's like you kind of have this superpower to kind of jump in their body and see things through their eyes. And it's really...
That's a lovely way to put it, actually.
You sort of feel reborn. I think that's... And that's what I really felt sad about when I was unsure if I could have children. Although I knew I would have... Somehow I was going to... I would have adopted. I would have done something in the end to have a child because I desperately wanted to kind of... You just want to share the world with someone else, desperately. And it's really, yeah, it's kind of like having, it's an amazing kind of renewal. It's like shedding your skin halfway through life and being able to just appreciate the joy of stuff again that you, you know, I think I was a bit jaded and that's completely gone now.
Oh, that's lovely. I mean, did you have a childhood that's at all similar to the childhood they're having?
No. No, it was quite pretty different, actually. It was in the country. We take them to the country a lot, actually. So they have their moments there where they're really free running kind of wild outside. And that's, so that definitely has some parallels. But no, I went to a little village school, which had 25 people in the entire school.
Oh, wow.
whereas Cliff has got more people than that in his entire class.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have many people coming and going through. My parents didn't get on very well. So they weren't, you know, I didn't have that kind of happy marriage as a model. I know it was really different, actually.
Yeah, it's interesting when you realise that the things you've picked up and the things you just sort of change for them.
I mean, I do think one day I always think we will move to the country at some point, maybe in time for secondary school, probably just at the point when they want to be in the city. I'll drag them off, so there will be parallels. But no, I often look at them and think, wow, your child is so different to mine. You know, you're living in the city, you're a city child. And you have all of these different people coming and going. And, you know, I'm not saying it's any better or worse, really, but it is different. It'd be interesting to see how it affects them.
Yeah. And before I let you go, when they have friends come over, are their friends curious to look in the freezers in your basement? Because I would definitely want to do that if my friend
had. Well, actually, it's quite funny because I did during... when we weren't... The school's relaxing a bit about letting us in inside the school gates and things, but during that period when they were back at school but we weren't allowed in, they had a day about jobs people do day or something where they all got to dress up as different jobs, and I had a last minute kind of panic about what he was going to be, so we just threw loads of paint over his clothes and he went in as an artist. And then they asked if any parents would like to do a Zoom call to the class and talk about their job. So he always wants me to do all of this stuff, and I'd missed out on school trips and stuff. So I said, yeah, I'll do that for your class. And the teacher was quite excited because she said, oh, this is going to be quite a fun one because you've got a studio and everything, and can we see the studio? And I said, yeah, it's fine. Anyway, I came last, I think, in the day, and the kids were all really bored and tired because they were all like 4 years old. So they were all like, they kept getting up off the mat and running around. And she kept saying, I'm so sorry, Polly. I'm really sorry. They're just a bit tired. But she was going, will you sit down? She's trying to talk to you about her work. And I just wasn't engaging them at all. And I said, who wants to look in my freezer? And they all went like, yeah. And I was like, no, who wants to see some dead snakes? And they went crazy. So at that point, they all just sat down like that. She said, right, sit down and you can see some dead snakes. And they all just sat glued to the carpet, staring at the screen while I took them through the freezer and pulled things out. And they still, like, they run up to me now and go like, can we see your dead snakes again?
That's
and one
awesome.
Of them, he's only had one kid back since then, actually. And yeah, as I was about to run him home, I said, do you want to have a quick look downstairs? So yeah. I did take him down there, yeah. So hopefully, like I say, I'll enter into a cool period for a couple of years, and then it'll be like, can you just lock the basement, please, and like hide all your work when my friends come around?
I don't know. I was thinking about, like, because I think I saw something where you say that sometimes you've got a few people that do just sort of randomly send you animals that might be suitable for your work. And sometimes they arrive without warning. And like here, if people open my packages by accident, they'll get some like random sequined ice skating costume on from eBay. But they open your package, Mom, someone sent you a rabbit.
Yeah, no, I even had one guy once sent me a live snake once.
Oh, what, by accident?
I don't think it was by accident. He was a very odd guy. I think he was like playing weird games. I don't know. But he said it was. But I did then. I looked into the snake, which was a harmless snake called a hognose. And they do play dead a lot, apparently. So it's possible that he just wasn't paying much attention and he slung it in this Tupperware. But I didn't open it. It was this intern I had at the time. She opened it and it started moving and she completely freaked out, poor thing.
We always alerted
the dogs would always run to the package, so I'd always be alerted about a dead animal by my sniffer dogs.
Ah, very smart, but helpful, helpful canines. Oh, cool. So you said you like to learn through sort of tactile means. Is that something you introduce with your kids too? Have they participated in that with you?
Well, I've just noticed that kids, they are so sensory, aren't they? I mean, one of their favourite toys is always slime, all of that stuff that they just love. Like, I often interject I'm always yelling at them at supper times and I have to sort of stand back sometimes and think, oh, just let them smash the jelly all over the counter. You know, they're obviously really enjoying it. Just this morning, my son Bruce wouldn't eat any breakfast. I ended up giving him a biscuit because I was desperate for him to eat something. And I turn around, he just smashed the whole thing into a big pile of crumbs and he was just like really delightedly making a little kind of pyramid out of them. And it's like that is the way they learn. They're like little scientists, aren't they? I mean, they're constantly conducting experiments all the time. Yeah. And I have to keep reminding myself that because it's not really mess to them. They're just learning. So, yes, I will absolutely encourage that in terms of like work and play. And I want to. I will completely sit down with them and skin an animal at some point if they will. I've got Cliff is kind of very, he's very clean and neat and he likes to wear suits. And I've got a feeling he might find it a bit messy. He really loves to please me and to do things that I do. So I think he'll do it as long as he's got a pair of rubber gloves or something. And I think Bruce will probably just end up smearing himself with blood.
That's quite an image. A suited person in little gloves, age 5. And
Yeah,
bloodstained one. But I think actually it being not squeamish about the circle of life is brilliant. I'm really glad I was raised that way. It's actually a really nice to not freak out about it because it is something that surrounds us.
It's just a helpful tool, isn't it, when you're growing up? I think you can't, you're going to get a real shock otherwise.
Yeah.
You can't avoid it forever.
Yeah, exactly. I'd be up for doing some more taxidermy. I'd have to come over and
bring the kids.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a family, another family day with a rabbit this time.
That sounds perfect. I'd honestly be up for that. Yeah. I do think my kids think I'm quite odd with a lot of the stuff that's in the house, but they don't really bat an eyelid after a while.
No, exactly. They just accept everything. That's what I love about children. They just don't. I honestly think there was a period when Clifford thought that everyone had snakes in the freezer. You just, you know, that's just normal life to you.
Of course, you wouldn't even question it.
Yeah.
Good names, by the way, Clifford and Bruce.
Do you like them?
Brilliant
Thanks.
Names.
Bruce started as a joke and then we learnt to love it. We were trying to think of the least, we were saying, now, what's the least likely name to become fashionable soon? Because, like, all of the other ones that we liked had obviously been taken thousands of times. And then I remember we were winding each other up laughing. Kenneth was another one I liked. And then I said, what about Bruce? And Matt was like, oh my God, we can't call a baby. Can you imagine a baby called Bruce? And I was like, actually, I can. He went, yeah, I love it.
That's wonderful.
And I looked up because they've had the Office of National Statistics have done kids' names recently.
Yeah, well, you can see the percentage.
Yeah, and actually, Bruce isn't doing too badly. I think there was about 30 last year.
Really?
Clifford, two.
Too close.
So he's like dropped off almost dropped off entirely, which I'm quite pleased about secretly.
I know, I love that. I've actually done that, and the one I did the best on, I think, was Ray. There's just hardly any little kids called Ray.
Yeah,
and I love the fact it's such an old man name. Yeah. I really love
it. But it's lovely when you think of a ray of sun, it's a lovely word.
It is, yeah. You get involved in,
What are all your five then? You've got Kit, Ray, Mickey.
Yeah, you've done it in an odd order, so have I missed out? Jesse and Sunny. Yeah, so Sunny, Kit,
Sunny's
Ray,
lovely.
Jesse,
I think
Mickey.
We had that at some point on a list.
Yeah.
Sorry, say that again.
So Sunny, who's 17.
Yeah.
Kit, who's 12.
Who you just met.
9-year-old Ray, 5-year-old Jesse, and 2-year-old Mickey.
Wow, 5 boys. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's funny.
It really is. Well, just 5, actually. It's quite amazing.
I know, 5 of anything.
I know.
Yeah.
Was it always a plan? Did you plan to have that many kids?
No, I don't think I did. I sometimes feel like I just would have had one, in a way. One or lots. I mean, Yeah, it's funny as well. Now, though this, I know this sounds quite eccentric of me, but I sort of feel like I can't really remember how I got to this point, because I was sort of in the flow, I think. Yeah. And they'd always get to about two and I'd think, oh, one more. I mean, when I had my third, I literally asked the consultant on the day I gave birth if it would be okay to have another one, maybe.
Wow.
Because I've had all C-sections as well, so I was worried about that. Maybe they might say, no, three is done.
Okay. And then, I didn't realise there was any kind of limit on that, actually.
No, I don't think that. Well, like, maybe there used to be. And then when I was having my fourth, I was very, I kept saying, this is my last baby, definitely. And then I got about halfway through the pregnancy, I was like, maybe not. And then I had Jess, and then about, when he was about 18 months, I just got really, really broody. Wow. I don't really feel like I knew what broody was until...
No, I actually don't think I do know what broody is still now. I don't really get it when I'm around other babies.
It wasn't just like I want... It wasn't like just a desire. It was like my brain kept turning all thoughts towards baby. It was very... It was actually quite annoying, if I'm honest, because I felt like...
You had to cure it, shut it up, silence it by getting pregnant.
A little bit. I sort of spoke about it a bit. Was mainly met with, you know, probably not a great idea from, like, most of the family. But I could see a little chink in the armour for Richard. I thought, I'm going to just push on.
That.
Yes. Yeah, I thought I just would like one more. And now my brain is being quite... Because they're
again.
At the same age where there's normally another one.
And, so there's an age where
and
you're
it's not
vulnerable,
just me.
Basically.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think so. And also the kids start talking about it a lot. So my 12-year-old is very insistent. He's like, one more.
Really?
He's got no idea how biology works. He said to me, can you just have one more?
Wow.
And I was like, I said,
that's
kid, you know,
sweet,
I'm...
That's really nice that a 12-year-old really, would want another one. I would have thought that was
it.
A kind of age where he was a bit over
no, he's
having
really
younger.
Into it. And he said, I said, kid, I'm already 42. I wouldn't be able to have another baby till I was 43. And he was like, well, he was going, I said, how long do you think it takes to make a baby? He said, 9 months. I said, exactly. It's just going to take a while, no matter what. So it's got, I'm going to be a bit older, I think. And he's like, well, I mean, you had Jesse in November. And I was like, no, you can have a baby in any month of the year, but I can't have choose that it's November yeah. coming up, because that's just not how it works. There's a lot, actually, of fundamental lack of grasp of what actually goes on. I mean, when I told him about the last baby, I said, I'm having a baby. And he said, so did you have SEX last night? I was like, 9 months ago. And he went, why didn't you tell me?
No,
not 9 months.
Didn't you
I said, 3 months
me?
Ago, why won't you tell me? I said,
Kit, we just had sex.
I was like, Kit, you do not want the kind of childhood where your mother tells you every time your parents do it. Like, just trust me
That's
on that.
Hilarious.
That is not what you want.
Well, so I suppose he thinks every time you have sex, you get pregnant.
Exactly, we'll exactly.
See, yeah. God, I couldn't even think about it. I remember the second one, it was more a case of, I definitely want to have another child at some point. I should probably get going because of the IVF, I thought. So that's, and then it just worked. So that was great. But now the thing is, we've got this weird situation where we have one. When I did IVF for Bruce, we did genetic screening again. And this round was just a really successful round. And we had two this time that came through the screening. So we've got one frozen. So I've got this really weird situation where, even though I think if I had never had fertility problems, I would have gone for two kids, I feel like I've got a third on. I just paid for the storage for another year the other day. And once they've reached day five, when they freeze them, they've already got a sex, a hair colour, an eye colour. All of those things are determined. So to not give it a chance, to me, feels like having an abortion. So and I'm 41, so I'm feeling a bit like, oh, I'm quite old to have another child now. But I feel like at some point I'm absolutely going to have to give it a chance.
Isn't
and
that
the lucky thing for me is it's the embryo of a 36-year-old, so I could even, I mean, I'm not going to do this, but you could do it when you're 50 and it doesn't make a difference, because it's the age of the embryo, not the womb, that's important.
Isn't that amazing?
I know it is, but I feel like I have to make my mind up on that really soon.
Oh, that's like a whole
but
other...
I really did not feel ready. I mean, wow, Bruce is such a handful. It's taken until he's three, I think, to even... I have started thinking, okay, I now that they're kind of playing together a bit more and not trying to kill each other.
That's a whole... I can't even imagine having that.
But they probably help a little bit too, right? Do they help... The older kids must help a bit when you've got a baby. Like, at least
yes.
you don't...
No,
you know,
they're
when
brilliant
got,
with
when
that.
You've got one, you can't leave the room because you might kill... You can at least say, just make sure
oh,
the
no,
baby
no,
doesn't
really
fall
helpful.
Down the stairs.
Yeah, there's definitely a bit of that goes on. I think, for me, it's more like, I can't imagine what it must feel like to have... It's not just a... Because sometimes you get that kind of idea of someone you know, oh, is there another baby out there that could join, another kid that could join the family? But actually knowing that...
Well, that's the problem, because I would have to make a decision. And, you know, women do this all the time. And some women... IVF was semi... went quite well for me in terms of what, how many embryos produced. But some women produce loads of embryos and they have, like, 6 or 7 frozen. So it's kind of... They just have to decide to... You just switch it off, basically, and the embryos die at that point. But I think the fact that it's just one as well, if it was three... then I'd almost find it easier to just get, because I'm definitely not going to have 3 more kids, whereas one more just feels like... And also because it's Bruce's twin, they were created on the same day.
Wow.
And it was completely random which one was put in first, which is kind of amazing. And then I will always feel guilty that I gave one of them life and not the other one.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a very weird thing. I mean, I know someone with 2 children, both created... Well, there must be hundreds of people like this.
Mm.
2 children, one's older than the other, but it's entirely down to chance which one they've put in that day. Who's the eldest and who's the youngest?
Wow. I mean, there's enough of a kind of miraculous nature to what...
I know, to conception
anyway.
Yeah,
conception anyway. That's like a whole extra layer, but completely brilliant. And also the stories that, you know, will come out of it all and the generations that come forward. I mean, it's just, it's wonderful. What an amazing... I love that about family, the way the cards fall, and that ends up being so part of what makes us and so defining. But actually so much of it is just this, really, everybody's got like their own little wiggly route to where they ended up. Well, thank you for complimenting my wonky taxidermy. That's very generous.
No, I feel like I wasn't complimentary enough. I'm sorry.
No, you were
extremely good first effort.
It was literally
way better than mine.
Exactly the level of compliment that I'm probably slightly above, actually, though. So when you said that mice aren't a good thing to start on, what would you have suggested as a good starter animal?
Probably a rabbit.
Rabbit? That's huge.
Yeah, but it takes... you can pull a rabbit's skin off very quickly, whereas you have to go very carefully with a mouse, and their skins are very tough. You're less likely to tear it.
Okay. Learn something new every day.
Yeah. I'll try that next time.
Okay, next up, rabbit. That's brilliant. Ah, thank you so much, Polly. What a brilliant, brilliant chat. And just if you're someone that's listening that is going through IVF or knows someone that they care about that's going through IVF, I just want to send lots and lots of love and support your way, because I know what a big, big deal that is. And thank you to Polly for speaking so openly about it, because I think it's very easy to feel so, so alone in that process. And she's right. So there's a lot of women that don't really speak about it too much because you don't kind of want to jinx it. Also, it's probably very hard to articulate just how much it's taken over your life when other people are not experiencing the same thing as you. But actually, in my house, when I was a teenager, my stepmom went through a few rounds of IVF, and I could see firsthand what a huge deal it was. And obviously, I've had some very close friends of mine go through it. And in fact, one of them's going through it as we speak. So yes, just sending lots and lots and lots of love and support your way. And I hope you're feeling good about everything and that you've got good people around you, because, yeah, it's a lot. And also, I love the idea of Polly having her kids bring over mates to go and see the dead snakes in the freezer. It makes me feel a little bit less weird about my house, which is filled with loads of rubbishy stuff and bits and bobs to look at, and the occasional dead animal maybe that's been stuffed by, you know, me and their dad. Actually, you know what? I don't think my kids have ever shown our little taxidermy mice to any of their mates. Maybe I should start bringing that up. Conversation starter. You know, do your friends want to see our taxidermy? Yeah, I'll try that out next week. Anyway, may I just leave it in your mind about my kitchen disco dance-a-thon for next week? I know I'm now banging on about it, but it would just be really amazing if you could just support me in any way. So, yeah, I think it's going to be really motivating when I start actually raising tons of money for children in need. So I'd love you to be a part of that, if you'd be so kind. It would really mean a lot to me. Or maybe even if you just message me with a really good dance move that will take some pressure off my lower back during my 24-hour challenge, that'd be cool too. And come and join me. You can find me on the red button. I believe it's on BBC Sounds for the entirety, or you can listen back to part of it on BBC Sounds as well. And... you know what I'm supposed to do from today is I'm supposed to stop drinking caffeine, because apparently if I have a week off caffeine, that'll mean when I drink caffeine next week, it's going to have much more impact. but I don't really want to stop drinking caffeine. I really like it. What I'm thinking I might do is stop coffee from today, because that's the big one, isn't it? I don't know if you drink coffee, but I have one a day and I really look forward to it. So I might stop drinking coffee from now, and then I might go decaf tea maybe from like tomorrow or the next day, just sort of wean myself down a little bit. I love my tea, but then decaf's all right, isn't it? Maybe I won't really notice it that much because it'll taste the same. No, I'll definitely notice it. I love caffeine. Anyway, I would like it to have an impact when I drink it next week, so I guess it's worth the sacrifice, maybe. I'm supposed to be doing core exercise as well, but not so much. I'm going to find out a lot about myself, aren't I, when I'm 16 hours in and everything on my body hurts. Anyway, don't worry about it. They don't call it a challenge for nothing. Next week's guest, there's two people it might be, so I'm not going to say anything because I've got myself tied in knots with that before. And in the meantime, I'm still on tour with Steps, where I'm off to this week. I've got Manchester this week and Aberdeen, I believe, and lots of other fun stuff. So I'll see you here next week, or I'll see you on the road somewhere, or you'll find me on the red button. Basically, if you want me, you know it's fine. All right, in the meantime, have an amazing week. Love you lots. Bye. Bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.